to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, Catholic book blogger. And today we have with us Daria Little, who has a PhD in politics from Durham University, England, and an MA in history from Gulbenkian University, Turkey. Her articles on foreign affairs have appeared in academic journals and Catholic World Report. She converted from Islam to Catholicism in her early 20s and now is living in Pennsylvania with her husband and three children. She's the author of the recent released book, From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God, published by Ignatius Press. Welcome to the show, Daria.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So this was actually an incredible book, and as I read through it, I couldn't help but think, wow, what a journey. Not only your spiritual one, but your life journey from Turkey to the United States, and we'll be covering a lot of that today on the show. But first, can you share us a bit about your childhood in Turkey and the struggles you faced? I think it's important for people to understand from America that are listening what it's like in the Middle East growing up.
Turkey is much different from most of the Middle Eastern countries because at the end of the World War I, we kind of separated from the Ottoman Empire, and the founder of the modern Turkey wanted a more secularized and a modern nation, away from the Muslim influence. So, for instance, he banned Arabic script, so we now write with the Latin alphabet, but in Turkish, of course. And he banned a headscarf, and he carried out many reforms to make the country more secularized, but of course you can't get rid of the religion just like that. So the country is still very much Muslim, but when you look at on the outset, it looks much more modern. If you go to Istanbul, it feels like a European city. It's been changing under the current administration somewhat during the last decade, but when I grew up in the 80s, I didn't see a person wearing a niqab or hijab till I was in my late teens. So it was much different back then. And so I went to the public school, learned about this these secular ideas of secularism and democracy, and then I came back home, and my parents were nominally Muslim. I mean, still definitely Muslim, mm-hmm. but they didn't practice it much. They sometimes fasted during Ramadan. My mother was a little more religious than my father. And in the summers, I learned how to recite the Quran in Arabic. I memorized all the Arabic prayers. So it was kind of a different experience than other Muslim children in different countries would experience.
Okay. So in the book, I think this is still, I don't know, maybe a common thing. I'm kind of learning this as I go along as well as I read your book, but you describe the culture growing up as just how poorly women are treated. And what is the plight of women today in Muslim culture? Because I think being that we're so distant from that here in America, we don't truly understand what it's like to be a woman in that culture.
The women in Turkey are somewhat more lucky than other Muslim countries, because in Islam, women are definitely second class. There's a gender hierarchy in that man is the head of everything, but it's more like it's more submissive in the sense that again it's like a master or slave relationship, like they have with Allah and men. So it's kind of there's a strict hierarchy. Islam teaches that two women's testimony are worth one man. So and women are inherently flawed, and they need to be kept in line, and also they need to be covered because so that they wouldn't seduce men with their feminine appearance. Mm-hmm. And hence the burqa and the hijab. So like different countries take it to different levels. So in Turkey it wasn't as strict, but at the same time it's an inherently Muslim nation. So that means the gender hierarchy is still there. For instance, my mother worked as a nurse outside the home, and she still had to come home, cook three courses of meal, take care of us, take care of all the needs of the house, while my father came home and expected to be served, because that was the woman's place.
Okay.
Or, like, he had affairs all the time, which was socially acceptable, even though polygamy is illegal in Turkey. It was okay for men to kind of wander. That's what we are told, as long as he comes home to his wife and his children. So, and of course, it's unacceptable for women, you know.
Right.
So there's always a double standard in the favor of men. And the more east you go in Turkey, the more religious the country gets. So, I mean, the practice is even different in different parts of the nation.
Okay. So hearing you speak about this, it may lead into a little better understanding of my next question, and that is, you write in the book about how your parents get divorced, and eventually you shirk off the Islam faith and you become an atheist. So what drove you from Islamic faith to no faith at all?
My parents got divorced when I was around 11, because finally my father decided to marry one of these women that he was having an affair with, and my mother had enough, basically, and she felt humiliated, so she decided to get a divorce. But back then, divorce was basically unheard of in Turkey. It's more common now. So, and I felt very betrayed, because it was a really messy divorce. There were fights and physical, they got physical, and I felt like they lied to me my whole life. So it was really heartbreaking for me. And I started to question everything they taught me as a child. So that was the beginning of my questioning of everything. And then on top of that, the more I tried to pray and find consolation in Islam, I felt like there was nobody on the other end. I felt like I was just talking to, like praying to somebody that wasn't there. And I mean, this could happen to any child of divorce anywhere in the world. So the combination of both made me, for the first time, want to read about Muhammad and Islam for myself, not what I hear from others, but with a critical eye for myself, and see if this was something I wanted to follow.
Okay. So now you also talk about in school how rigid, I guess is the word I want to use, the teaching of the Islamic faith is. Is that still the case today? Is it still, it seems almost as if the faith is pushed on a person.
Yes, yes, definitely. It's not like you have a choice. First of all, there is the social pressure that you have to be Muslim. It's like unheard of. I never met somebody who was outside the Muslim faith. So you have to be Muslim. And there's a really intense shame culture. Like, you cannot shame your family by leaving your religion. That's one thing. And also, yes, the national identity we have in Turkey is very different. For instance, in America, who is an American? America, we cherish freedom here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of being an American, the rugged individualism and being free, and not answering anybody. And basically, if you completely turn that upside down, then you will find something similar to the Turkish identity, which is being a Turk means you have to be Muslim. There is no question. But you can't be too Muslim like the Arabs or the Persians. So you can't be too Muslim, but you can't be anything else either. So it's pushed on us in a secular sense, and in social sense as well. So you're in this, like, cage in a way that your identity is already decided for you.
Gotcha. So in Turkey, it seems like you might be a little sheltered from the extreme Islamists. Is that the case?
you would think, but no, because of all these reforms that was made back in the 1920s, the ISIS and all the radical Muslims, they think Turkey is another apostate nation, basically, because we are not Muslim enough. You know, does it make sense? Because we are not following Islam to its strict code. And, I mean, it's changed a lot. It's become more towards the towards Islam since I moved to the West because of our current president. So it's not as secular as before, but still it's not in the same line as ISIS. And there are a lot of ISIS attacks in Turkey, too.
Gotcha. All right, with that, we're going to take a quick break, and Duriel, when we come back, we'll get more into your conversion story itself. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. I'm Pete Sox, the Catholic Cook Blogger, and we'll be right back. First segment, we talked a lot about Islam and Turkey as a country, and I want to get into your conversion story, Duriel, which is basically the foundation of this book, and quite a conversion story it is. We did touch on it a bit, that after your parents were divorced, you became atheist, but you had an encounter with a Christian missionary at one point, and I think that story proves how God works in mysterious ways. Your intent with this missionary was to convince them that there was no God, but the tables were turned slightly, weren't they?
Yes. And thank God, Holy Spirit knows us really well. When I met this missionary, I felt so sorry for her. I wanted to help her so she didn't continue believing in these fairy tales. So little did I know that she herself was a convert. She grew up in an unbelieving family. So she was ready for everything I could throw at her way. And so for 3 years, all we talked about was God. And by then, when I met her, I was 19 years old. So by then, I was a staunch atheist. I had figured out all the secrets of the universe as teenagers do. So I really wanted to help this woman to find the light just as I have.
So during this conversion process, I think it's really interesting, and I'm going to read a paragraph here out of your book where you're talking about this whole experience of going from atheism to Christianity. And you state, "Contemplating what all my friends would think of me if I became Christian weighed on me. I was surrounded by people who were either atheist or agnostic. I had only one practicing Muslim friend. He was a very good friend who helped me to study for many an exam. He was the least of my worries when it came to the risk of friendships. My other friends, including my fiancé, would be a different story. By becoming Christian, I would appear to be turning my back on them. Since my familial relationships were weak, what my friends thought was very important to me." And then you go on to quote scripture where you say, "I was very much like the man who told Jesus, 'I will follow you, Lord, but let me first say farewell to those at my home.'" I think that's very interesting, and I think conversions are in a sense all like that. They're not always cut and dry. There's internal struggles many converts face as they're going through the process, especially for those that are going from atheism to Christianity, from professing no belief in a God to saying there is one. So can you share a bit with us what was going through your mind as you wrestled with this decision?
It was I didn't see ahead of me. That was the biggest thing, because when you're at that conversion place, you feel like you're alone in the universe. Mm. And by talking to Therese, I had figured out and I had come to the conclusion that God existed and that I needed Christ. But I couldn't make that decision. As I said, my hand was on the plow, but I kept looking back. I kept looking back. I didn't want to go forward. It was agonizing. I remember losing sleep for days because I just didn't know what awaited me. Because you don't think about, yes, you'll make new friends and the Lord will provide, but you just don't see that in that moment of decision.
Mm-hmm.
Again, thankfully, Holy Spirit knows us. So one day I was going to a classroom, and I had this vision. And you need to remember that I'm an atheist still, technically.
Right.
So I don't believe in visions and stuff, but I think God just had enough of me. You know, it's like, okay, I'll slap you in the face. I saw this little girl sitting on the ground. It's like outdoors. Beautiful background, and she's wearing a white dress, playing with these little toys in front of her, and she's really busy. And then there are two hands coming from the sky. You can't see the owner of the hands, you just see the hands, and they're handing a beautifully wrapped gift to this little girl. I mean, this gift, you can tell that it's invaluable. It's priceless.
Mm-hmm.
It's glowing. It's beautiful. You don't quite know what's inside, but you know you must have it. So the girl doesn't even see the gift for a while, and then finally she looks up and she tells the owner of the hands, "No, thank you. I have these little things to play with." So I'm looking at this girl. Are you stupid? How can you even compare this gift, which is beyond any of your imagination, to the little tiny toys you're playing with? And I realize I'm that girl.
Hmm.
And then I'm comparing all the friends or my career to the gift that Christ is offering me freely. And the following day, I converted at the age of 22.
Awesome. And as you say in your book, thankfully, the Holy Spirit is more stubborn than I am.
Yes, he is, thankfully, definitely.
So as your journey continues, and that's what I find compelling about your entire conversion story, is you start off Islamic, go to atheist, now you're an evangelical Christian, but it doesn't stop there. Something happened. So what drew you to start looking into the Catholic faith? Because so far, you have a three-step process there that took you to an evangelical Christian, and a lot of people would stop there. But you continued exploring.
I think if I left to my own devices, maybe I would not have found the Catholic Church. But before even I started looking into Catholicism, I had questions about Protestant theology. Like, I never quite understood sola scriptura or sola fide, like only Bible, only faith, and I didn't understood the lack of a magisterium, that Jesus would die on the cross, resurrect, and leave without any guidance until a Bible is formed to followers who don't even read back then, you know, most of the literate. So I didn't quite understand the historical process, but I thought maybe I just don't know enough. So I kind of pushed it aside until a very good friend of mine decided to become Catholic, and I was appalled. How could he do this? You know, to me, like growing up, we have all these anti-Catholic feelings. You know, all the bad guys are Catholics. In the old Turkish movies, and we have the Crusades, like all really bad historical connotation, and I could not believe. So I set out to prove my friend wrong, and then again, again I was wrong. I mean, how many times can one person be wrong in her life? And I was wrong again, and I found all the answers to the questions I had in the Protestant theology answered in the Catholic Church. So then I was confirmed in England when I was getting my PhD.
Gotcha. So one thing I have to ask is, a lot of times when people come to the Catholic faith, they find one stumbling block that holds them back, that they have a lot of time coming to grips with. For some people, it's Mary. For some people, it's the transubstantiation. Did you experience anything of that, or did your journey, because of how long it was or how many bus stops, so to speak, there were, did you not have that kind of struggle?
I think most of the struggles people deal with, as much as the Protestants, I did not. The biggest issue for me was the magisterium. So if there is an authority, if you accept that the Christ left an authority, and then and that authority tells you something, this is part of our faith, then you obey. You trust their wisdom, and you trust that Holy Spirit is able to protect the faith. So the only thing it was hard for me to settle was IVF and surrogate parenthood and such things. Like, I didn't understand why the church will deny children to people. So I didn't quite understand the wholeness of those teachings, but in time I have come to see the wisdom in it, of course. But no, I didn't have any problem with Mary, because I think it's very clear in the Old Testament from my readings, and also in my culture, despite the gender hierarchy, mothers are very revered. So if as a sinful person I revere my own mother, then how much would a perfect God honor his own mother? So I had no problem with those general problems. Yeah.
And one thing I want to maybe backpedal a little bit, just to give people a feel for this, because I've read this, I understand this, but when it comes to Mary and the Muslim faith, Mary is actually, I don't know if revered is the one I want to use, but respected in the Muslim faith, is she not?
Yes, actually, she was mentioned more often in the Quran than Jesus was. So I believe the conversion of Muslims will be through Our Lady eventually, because of that reverence. But they were, she wasn't revered as, of course, the mother of God. She was revered as the mother of a prophet.
Right.
And because of that, like the respect we give to our parents, kind of, but it is interesting, you're right.
Yes, it is. Let's take another quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about some of the books that you read that helped with your conversion story. So with that, we're going to take a break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Pete Sox and Catholic Book Blogger here on Redbox Media, and we'll be right back. Describe as an ugly little book by a man I'd never heard of. That author was Mark Shea, and it left an impression on you. And that book was By What Authority an Evangelical Discovers Catholic Tradition. And Mark, who is also here on Breadbox Media, if you're listening, you need to find a better cover designer, brother. Tell us how that book started steering you towards Catholicism, Durya.
Okay, so this friend of mine who became a Catholic, we lived in different cities. So I went back to my dorm room, and I'm like, okay, I will prove him wrong. So I went to the library, and I looked for books on Catholic theology, and they had one monstrous volume written by this guy called Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger.
And there you go.
Whoever that was, I mean, I have no idea. And I open it, and I have no idea what he was talking about. I mean, because I just didn't know anything about Catholic theology to understand mm-hmm. it. I closed it with respect and put it back on the shelf. And I went back to my room, and there was an envelope waiting for me. This friend of mine who converted to Catholicism, he said, "So that you know, I haven't completely gone crazy or insane." So this little book by Mark Shea, so I'm in Turkey, right, thousands of miles away from this Mr. Shea, mm-hmm. and it didn't look as intimidating as the book of Cardinal Ratzinger. So, and I read it, and I found there all these answers to all these questions that have been bothering me in the Protestant church. And I just couldn't believe, and that was the beginning of my entrance to the Catholic Church. So I'm very grateful to Mr. Shea for having written that book.
Yeah, and that book's been read by quite a number of people, and they've all experienced the same thing, sort of an eye-opening experience. So you alluded to writings of someone I feel will be named a doctor of the church someday, and that's Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who we know as Pope Benedict XVI. Did you eventually get a chance to dive into any of his books?
Yes, it's interesting because he was the Pope back then. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. I mean, I didn't know what these crazy Catholics did. You know, they changed their names and all that stuff. And yes, after I converted and had a little better understanding of Catholic theology, I read many of his books and many of his writing, and I just love it how concise and clear he is. It's like a bit of fresh air, and mm-hmm. yeah, he will always have a special place in my heart, and hopefully he will be declared a doctor of the church one day.
Yes, which would be great. So I'd asked you a question earlier about your stumbling blocks in the faith, and in that same chapter where you're talking about Cardinal Ratzinger and Mark Shea's book, you talk about four things that you would consider your main objectives as inconsistencies among Protestants, you state. And the first of them is sola scriptura. We briefly touched upon that. What can you tell us about, one, how did you quantify that in your own mind as you went through this conversion process?
Okay, so the four ones were sola scriptura, only Bible, sola fide, only faith, that mm-hmm. we are saved by faith alone, and not by works. The third one was the magisterium, yep. that in the Protestant churches there is none. And creationism was a big block for me because it almost made it sound like faith and science are not compatible. So as I read about it, I realized that the scripture actually was given to us by the Catholic Church. How can we trust that these are the books God gave us if there isn't already an authority that is ordained by God? Mm-hmm. So that doesn't take long, actually, if you follow the historical current and read the earliest writers, and like the Church Fathers. And, of course, you know, the only faith doctrine just did not make sense to me. It sounded like, okay, so I become a Christian, then my free will is gone. Like, once you're saved, God cannot take it away. Like, but it's not God taking it away. It's me rejecting him. Like, why can't I do it after I become a Christian? And in the Bible, if anything, the only thing that says is you're not saved by faith alone in Book of James. It never says you are saved by faith alone. So that wasn't that hard if you have the eyes to see, in a way. And the magisterium, of course. How is it that the creator of the universe would become man and die on the cross, resurrect and not leave anybody behind to protect his teachings. I mean, he knows us better than us. He knows that we will corrupt his teachings. So it didn't make sense that he would not leave anybody or anything behind to guide us through this hard journey. And of course, then, in a way, the creationism part is related to Sola Scriptura, because when you interpret the Bible all by yourself, you kind of have to take everything literally. So the problem with creationism is that it takes the account in Genesis as literal, whereas the Catholic Church doesn't, because the creation, the physical creation of the world is in the science of realm, not religion. So there is nothing incompatible there. Does it make sense? Like,
Yeah.
I was thinking, okay, if one day evolution is proved beyond doubt, then like, will or will our religion fall apart? You know,
uh-huh.
I mean, is there not any room? So, but then when you see it as the Catholic Church sees it, then you're like, there is nothing science can do that can hurt our faith. There's nothing. I mean, go and research and do what you want. Actually, it helps us to understand God and His creation better. So, yeah, as I said, I found all the answers in the Catholic Church.
Awesome. And welcome home.
Thank you. It is.
So I have to ask, and this will be a two-part thing, because your conversion was, in essence, two-part. You worried about what your friends and what your family would think as you converted from atheism to Christianity. So what did they think when that first happened, that you became an evangelical Christian?
When I first converted, it was a little awkward with my friends, because, I mean, in our free time, we made fun of people who were like me. Mm-hmm. So what does one do? So, and I drank a lot, and I had a very immoral life. So I stopped all those practices, and like I became weird to them. So eventually I drifted away from my friends, not like an outward rejection, but it was like we didn't have anything in common anymore. So we kind of drifted away, and I made new friends, so it wasn't that bad. It was a little bit harder with my fiancé, because even though he was okay with me becoming a Christian at first, he became really hostile as time passed, because I think, again, the changes in me he didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching the Case of Case for Christ. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yes.
Yeah, so I it was like that, but my fiancé never found Christ, because he never wanted to listen. He wouldn't even read anything I asked him to read, or he was very hostile. That's all I could say.
Mm-hmm.
We broke up eventually. With my family, actually, my faith helped instead of making things worse, because when I became a Christian, I was estranged from my father for years by then, and with my mother I had a very bad relationship, because she was really absent and abusive when I was growing up. But now that I knew I was a sinner and Christ also died for my parents, it's a completely different way looking at people. So by the grace of God, I was able to mend my relationship with them. It's not perfect, of course, but it's much better than what it would have been. So that's how things turned out, much better than I had hoped, I had expected.
So that was when you became an evangelical Christian. So, you know, what was the reaction when you went from evangelical Christian to Catholic? Because, you know, as you said, some people are like, you know, Catholic. So now you're going from Christian. Now you really went off your rocker and you're Catholic. Did you see any pushback from that conversion?
The only pushback I received from was from my evangelical Christian friends, because I was a lost cause for everybody else already. So, but yes, because I was surrounded with Christians who were very hostile to the Catholic Church. I mean, I was working with Southern Baptists, and one of them actually cried when I told him. It's this grown man crying because I'm becoming Catholic. And I was yelled at for reading Catholic books because I used to do interpretations for conferences. I heard many times the Pope called Antichrist and the Church Whore of Babylon. So I was in that. So I kind of kept it to myself. But I didn't lose anybody because I became Catholic, definitely. Eventually, all my even evangelical friends, they've become more open to the idea that maybe Catholics are Christians after all.
That's a good thing. So we're going to take one more break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. Your conversion story, Daria, and your story doesn't end there because you actually converted while you were at university in England, but ultimately you ended up coming across the Atlantic to America. What prompted that journey to America?
I never thought I would stray this far away from Turkey because my desire was to get my PhD, go back to Turkey, and hopefully be a light among Muslims. But I also wanted to marry somebody who was a good Catholic. I wasn't going to be with somebody who didn't share the same fire as I did. So I met my husband on Catholic Match. He was the first person I talked there, and he happened to be an American. Nobody's perfect, so... So he was living here. He was in the Air Force, and I traveled here. We met, and then we decided to get married. It was a very kind of whirlwind love affair, and we got married in my Catholic church in Ankara. And then now we live in America with our four beautiful saint makers.
Awesome, awesome! A nice little plug there for Catholic Match, by the way.
Yes, it is.
So your last chapter in the book, I think, speaks volumes to your faith journey and in this really unbelievable conversion story of yours that, I'm very happy that you wrote this book because I think it will appeal to many people. And it opens the world to people's eyes to the whole Islamic faith and your journey. Through that, and I hope a lot of people listen to this episode and understand what it was you experienced the whole way through this faith journey. But your last chapter is called Discovering the Joy of Spreading the Faith, and I think that is a very important thing, that once you have the faith, it doesn't stop there. We are called to spread that faith for Christ. So can you tell us a little bit about what that means to you?
It's in everything we do, and I think that's how it should be in all Christians. Because I am where I am, and my life is infinite the better because a woman from America decided to share her faith with me and moved across the ocean. I mean, she changed my life eternally. Not only that, I, as an atheist, I was miserable. I mean, I would never say this, but I was not happy. So it's like because somebody decided to share the joy of their faith I am where I am right now. And as Christians, that should be our mission with everything we do. I mean, that doesn't mean we all need to move to other countries. You know, we raise faithful families, or we go to work and, I don't know, be a listening ear to somebody, or we cook a dinner for college kids, or, you know, there's something everybody can do. As Mother Teresa said, do small things with great love. And that's what I'm trying to do, of course. Of course, I fail often, more often than I should, but that should be our Christian life, be salt to the world.
Yeah, we all fail. That's part of being human. So another thing you bring up in this chapter is the importance of prayer. How does prayer throughout your journey? I mean, you know, obviously it changed a bit. You weren't praying a rosary when you were evangelical, obviously. So how has your prayer life changed throughout your entire conversion process?
Obviously, I had none when I was an atheist, but mm-hmm. when I decided to see that there was God, I was more argumentative. Like, I was yelling at him for being so bad, you know, for letting so much evil happen. And after I converted, prayer really helped me to see others through the eyes of God a little better, and it definitely had a big impact on my reconnection with my parents. It's all written in my book in detail if anybody wants to see it. So, but it's always come hard to me. It's like my husband, I feel like he has this like phone conversation with God all the time, and it's never been that easy to me. But at the same time, if God is our friend, then it doesn't make sense if we don't share with him. So as the years passed, I've become better at it, and also it's part of a discipline too. I try to pray the rosary every day. At first it was just a decade, and now it's much better. But it's a discipline, but I think it's one of the most important things we should do as Christians.
Right. And another thing you talk about in that last chapter is continuing to feed your faith. You talk about some of the books you've read. You mentioned The Apostasy That Wasn't by Rod Bennett. I had Rod on the show, and we discussed that book. You mentioned a little bit of G.K. Chesterton. Catholic Answers in their books. Are there some books you can recommend people that you've found helpful in your conversion process beyond the two we've already talked about by Mark Shea and Pope Benedict / Cardinal Ratzinger?
It's like we become what we eat, and it's only not physically true, but our intellect too. I mean, I love reading fantasy books as well and watching science fiction. Mm-hmm. But it's very important now that we have so many resources. Like, we can read, we can listen to the books, there are podcasts, there is radio. It's amazing. We have this wealth. So every Catholic, if you don't like reading, that's okay. Listen or mm-hmm. watch CW10. There is something, because what you listen, what you hear will shape your daily life. You will remember little things that is said by Mother Angelica, or, you know, it's so rich. I mean, I've learned so much about the faith, Catholic theology, Catholic living, by just listening to Catholic Answers. Or I wrote this book after I listened to a podcast by Al Cresta. I mean, you know, so it will shape our daily lives, definitely. So it's not only books. I just happen to be a geek and a reader of books, you know. So, but there's a lot of other ways that we can feed our minds and our souls. Let me see. I mean, it depends what you're interested in, but I really... want again plug in my own publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Anything from Ignatius Press is reliable and enjoyable. I've read mm-hmm. so many of their books even before they published my book. And again, the same as Catholic Answers, or I don't know if you have anything specific in mind.
Just wanted to see what you thought potentially was helped you in your own journey. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
So. Now, I want to briefly touch on your work. You write for a number of journals. I see you write for Catholic World Report. So can you tell us a little bit about your work outside of this book?
I got my PhD, I think 2013, it says on my parchment. And since then, I've been mostly changing diapers as a doctor. So,
that's important
so I haven't
work.
Done much. It is. And because the Lord has blessed me, I've written this book. I've written two fiction books for young adult. And I've written a few articles for Catholic World Report. And so I've been writing a few articles here and there for Islam. But mostly I've been mothering.
That's a perfectly good profession as well.
So, yes, it is.
Daria, can you tell us where people can find your book?
Sure. It's either on Ignatius Press website or on Amazon.
Awesome. So that's all we have time for today, Daria. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and spending time with us today. Any closing thoughts?
Of course. Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.